Greetings and welcome to the Music Is Your Business podcast, a series of programs to help you, the independent artist or band, learn more how to successfully prepare, promote, publicize, and sell your music. I'm Chris Knob of Forefront Media and Music, and I'll be your guide each program as we look at the many issues and challenges facing you, the independent musician. These podcasts are dedicated to helping you help yourself with the business of music. Well, greetings once again. I am Chris Knob, the host of the Music Is Your Business podcast. And my guest today is an author and former record producer and engineer, Moses Avalon. Moses is the author of several books. One in particular is used throughout music business programs at over 35 colleges and universities. It is called Confessions of a Record Producer. He also has written another book called Million Dollar Mistakes, as well as Secrets of Negotiating a Recording Contract. He is, as you'll hear on the program, what he calls an artist rights advocate. And also he is a well-sought-after speaker at conferences and workshops and a consultant to artists as well. Welcome to the show, Moses.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
And let's talk about this idea, since it's close to what we do here on this program, to really stand up for the independent artist. What do you mean when you call yourself an artist rights activist?
Well, there are two sides to my business, and one side is a for-profit and one side is non-for-profit. And the for-profit side is, as you mentioned before, you know, I'm a consultant to people in the music industry, and that money is generally taken and filtered into our non-profit side. And the nonprofit side is done for doing artist rights advocacy projects. And these are projects that are designed to make the music industry a safer place to be. Some of those projects, for example, one of them is called the Good Guys Database. And that's a free database that's on my website that people post their experiences, both positive and negative, that they've had with people in the industry. And this acts as kind of a, you know, low-grade Better Business Bureau. So if you, before you're about to do business with someone, you can just go to this database, type in a name, and see if there's any information, either good or bad, that's been written about them. Hmm. And, of course, maintaining that database requires a fair amount of effort, because we have to make sure that nothing slanderous is posted, and we have to monitor it. Another project that we do is music business education courses to teach artists how to hang on to their rights and how the music business really works. And we do those one, sometimes three times a year in Los Angeles and New York. And then there are various projects that I have when people are in bad record deals or have a complaint about a certain company. We investigate it and find out if the company that's offering the services is being truthful to the public, whether it's what we call artist safe or artist friendly, meaning that they're not exploiting other artists' work in the act of promoting whatever products they have. And we generally post those reports on my website, which is MosesAvalon.com. And on that website are all kinds of free tools for the musician to help them with their career. There's a digital distributor guide, which compares the deals of all the latest digital distributors out there. There's guidelines for how you should be scheduling your career. There's the Moses Opposes Archives, which has all my newsletters about companies and goings on in the music business, going back now close to 4 years. And royalty recovery projects. We did a project with a neighboring rights organization a couple of years back called Cena, where they had about $1 million in unclaimed royalties, and we found the artists who those royalties belong to and helped get that money into their hands.
I think you ought to take on a few more projects. You're not busy enough, Moses.
Yeah.
You know. But a lot of what you just talked about, I want to start with your website, because it is an extraordinarily useful website. And one of the ways I first found you several years ago was with your royalty calculator.
Oh, yeah.
Could you talk about that a minute, what that is and
sure.
How it's useful to people?
Sure. Well, the royalty calculator on the website is kind of a scaled-down version of a more advanced service that we offer as consultants. And frequently when a manager is negotiating with a record company, it's a very complex negotiation. There's a lot of things that go into negotiating what the royalty structure is going to be for their artist. So we provided this tool on the website where you can plug in the points of a record deal, press calculate, and it will tell you how many records you'll have to sell in that record deal before you make any real money.
Mm.
It'll also tell you your penny rate, which is how much the record company is really paying you for each sale, not what they tell you they're paying you. And it's free. It's very kind of scaled down so that anybody can use it without any real knowledge of the music industry. There's a little hint thing on the side, which if you click is actually almost like getting like 3 years of music business in one web page.
Mm.
Tells you all the algorithms behind each of the buttons, and reverse engineers all the record company accounting.
Well, that's why I think it's so valuable. This is a real eye-opener to people. You know, I've shown it to students that I've taught when I was in the Art Institute of Seattle's audio production program. And people just don't realize, who are novices and putting out the first record, you know, they find out someone's interested in signing them from a label, and they jump up and down and go, this is really great. And they don't realize what's really behind it. And when you look at the numbers, which you do really well, it opens people's eyes to, my God, I'm only getting X amount. What about this and all this recoupment issue? So,
I tend to be all about the numbers, and it's not that I'm insensitive to the creative side of music. I play five instruments myself, and I've written God knows how many songs and how many soundtracks in my life, so I'm a musician as well. But, you know, no one needs me to tell them how to write a great song or how to make a great record. That's what their instincts are for. But, you know, you do need someone like me to explain the real math of it and how you really make money in this business, because that is not explained anywhere except maybe in a four-year music business degree program, which most of us don't have the time or the money to invest in.
True. And so let's talk about the artist's challenges. If you're a new artist today, being a singer-songwriter or in a band, it seems to me, on the one hand, the Internet has many, many useful tools to stay independent, and yet there's still a lot of people, I think, that have been attracted by, let's say, American Idol, that are in what I call the discover me mode and want someone to do all the work and don't want to know anything, are kind of risk takers. Do you encounter that? Do you encounter both types of artists, ones who want to do it themselves and learn more, and the people who are sort of dreamers who are easily exploited?
Yes, but I only encountered the dreamers who are easily exploited after they're already exploited, because that's usually when they discover that they need someone like me. You know, I kind of get this email, I signed a deal and now I want to get out of it, and I realize what a terrible deal I signed. Mm-hmm. Now what could you do to help me? And, you know, I wish I could put the person in a time machine, send them back in time just 2 or 3 years and say, well, take my workshop, you know, because then you won't end up in this situation.
Yeah,
so
that,
I see both types.
That just happened to me over the weekend. I had a client that was all signed up to have some time with me, and then they called and said, never mind, Atlantic Records is interested in us, and we're set now, was his quote. We're all set now.
Right.
And, you know, what do you say to someone like that? If you had a chance, how would you respond to someone who said...
Tells me they're all set?
Yep, we're all set.
I'd ask them who their lawyer was, and if they gave me a name of someone that I recognized as competent and honest, then I'd say, great, you're all set. But if they gave me a name that was not on my A-list, I might be inclined to say, look, I'm sure your attorney is fine, but, you know, I think unless you want to end up being like some of those people you see on VH1's Behind the Music, you might want to take the time to understand how the deal works so that you can communicate better with your lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can understand how the business works, that you're not at the mercy of your attorney or your accountant. And it doesn't require much. You know, in 2 days, I teach you everything there is to know about the music business. So 2 days of your time invested to walk out with an education that could literally save your life and your career, to me, seems like a very small investment.
If we talk about this artist who has the idea of making their own record and putting it out and marketing themselves, do you advocate for artists to do that more and more, or do you still feel that they should try to hook up with a strong indie label or a major label if possible?
I think it really depends on the style of music that you're doing. I think if you want to be a pop artist, if your goal is to be like Christina Aguilera or something like that, you need to focus on major labels and what they provide. If your music is very niche, then you don't have to be, you know, tied down to that option. You have more options in terms of independent labels or doing things yourself. These days, almost everybody, with very few exceptions, has to at least make, market, and promote one record themselves before they're going to get on the major label radar. And yes, there are many exceptions to this rule, but by and large, it is the rule. They want to see that you have, that you know how to produce and create a product, that you have an understanding of marketing and distribution, and that makes you a better commodity to them. It makes something that, that's worth signing, it's worth investing, and you're not going to freak out on them the first time they sit down with you and have a conversation about marketing and how much needs to be spent, and you know, you're sitting there going, no man, it's supposed to be about the music, and I'm into all this marketing stuff, because then they're just going to get very, very frustrated with you. And that's one of the reasons why record labels sign more artists that have a stronger emphasis on image rather than an emphasis on talent. It's because those with less talent know that in order to succeed, they're going to have to play the major label game. And so they're more patient about the process. They've taken the time to understand business. And it's been my experience that those who are, you know, extremely talented, extremely creative, extremely innovative, also, for reasons I'm not fully clear on yet, have developed a philosophy that, you know, they don't need to play the label's game, the label needs to play their game. And that's why you see so many really talented musicians who aren't signed and aren't on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Would you add to the suggestion you made that an artist put out at least one album themselves and get some experience marketing, et cetera, would you add to that, that that record has to have some kind of success at some level of sales to impress the label?
Yes, it does, but the word success needs to be carefully defined in this
it
paradigm.
It does. Yes, it does.
Because most people think success means you've sold 500,000 records, where, you know, the reality is that most artists on major labels don't sell anywhere near 500,000 records.
Exactly.
You know, most of them are lucky to sell 50,000 records.
Yeah.
So, success needs to be redefined for this paradigm, and, you know, yes, the record needs to be successful, but what is success? That varies upon the type of music you're doing, the region that you're doing it in, and what's your budget to put it together. And I have seen situations where, you know, major labels have signed artists who've sold very few records but demonstrated an enormous amount of potential versus other artists, independent artists, who've sold tens of thousands of records and yet the major label won't touch them. And how to strategize your success are one of the things that I offer in basic consultations to independent artists.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things you can buy off my website for anywhere from $10 to a couple of $100. And these are, you know, basically conversations that I have with artists and consultations that we give away at cost. We're not really making any money on them. It's just my way of giving back to the community.
Well, there's a job that you know well enough that's historic in nature and has changed over the decades. It's known as artist development. And if we go back in record or music business history, there was more artist development in the 60s and 70s perhaps, and slowly it dissipated in the 80s to the 90s, where that transitioned because of the independent label boom starting in the late 70s and throughout the 80s to the present, that the artist has more responsibility to develop their talent, their skills, their artistry, so to speak. Whereas if we go back to bands or artists like Motown era, et cetera, where there was in-house support and a label would believe in an artist, put out several albums if they still believed in them, we're not in that kind of an era anymore. So an artist really has to prove themselves, like you said.
Well, there's been a shift, and there's upsides and downsides to the shift. I think you're right. There's less corporate artist development. But artist development is still going on at the independent level, on you know, more so than it ever has. Just the job has shifted from the in-house A&R person to the independent producer who lives down the street from you. He's now the person who's making an investment in developing acts and then shopping them to labels. That hasn't really changed, and the dynamic of that hasn't changed much, I don't think, since the 50s. One upside to not having so much corporate artist development is that when there was a lot of corporate artist development, you also had with it many, many, many stories about artists not getting paid. And with more development being done independently and then deals being shopped to labels once they're more well-refined, you get a smarter, more educated, more well-protected breed of recording artists. And therefore, they get to hang on to more of their money, and they don't have to end up in an expensive audit in 10 years.
I'm going to jump to a different arena and probably come full circle to some of the things we've talked about. But I want to ask you this question about your commitment to what you do now. Is that I think we have something in common, and I'll express it this way. You know, my experience was that I was sort of born what I call in music retailing. I had my own store in San Francisco in the 70s. And then I, you know, did some radio shows playing alternative music, and then I started a label. And as I went, I kind of learned the business on the School of Hard Knocks, I would call it. Mm-hmm. And as I grew throughout and landed up managing a radio station here in Seattle, I started to realize there wasn't a lot of information out there for the startup musician, and there that it was really kind of well-kept secrets. And I'm wondering, you know, if you, like myself, I know I came to a point where I wanted to share that information with people and let them know some things about what this business they're getting into is about. Was there, with your experience as a producer and a recording engineer, and you were, especially now we can talk about the important book of Confessions of a Record Producer, was there a time when you suddenly said to yourself, you know, all this stuff is going on that I see every day, but it's not getting out to people? Was there a catalyst, in other words, that made you do what you do?
Sure. It was having so many clients with gold and platinum records, you know, asking to borrow money from me.
And then what happened?
Well, I became very curious as to why these artists with such huge, successful albums didn't have any money. And Confessions of a Record Producer was the product. Started out as a diary, I guess, of all the ways the artists get ripped off, and that's what became my first book. And then, you know, when the book was successful, shouldn't say when it was successful. It's still very successful. It's required reading in over 35 music business programs, including NYU, UCLA, Loyola Law School, and a whole bunch of others. I started getting invited to sit on panels at all these music business conferences, which I'm sure your listeners go to all the time.
We hope.
And I started noticing that when I sat on these panels, that no real useful information was being conveyed to the audience.
Hear, hear.
That yes. People were just either giving self-serving answers, or most of the panelists were there because they were sponsors in some way of the seminars.
Yeah.
And or they were afraid to give real answers because they're sitting on the panel with their competitors and their constituents, and they don't want to embarrass anybody.
Exactly.
So I realized that in order to really educate people about the music business, you couldn't do it with a panel. You had to do it with something that was a closed lecture, something where you had complete control over the information and you weren't afraid to embarrass anybody, and something that had no sponsors. Because as soon as you invite ASCAP, BMI, you know, all the people who you generally see sponsoring these things, as soon as you invite them in to sponsor stuff, already you're limited as to what you can say, in much the same way that you're never going to see a show that's against big business and electricity and nuclear weapons on NBC News, because they're owned by General Electric.
Right.
So, and I hope that, I don't know if that's, you know, over the head of your readers or not, but listeners or not, but, you know, General Electric makes atomic weapons, and they also own Channel 4.
Indeed.
NBC. And so all their news shows are always going to be, you know, they're always going to skirt around certain issues that are sensitive to the parent company who owns them. And likewise, when you have a lot of sponsors at seminars, you end up in the same scenario. So I developed the Confessions of a Record Producer workshop with what's called a forum-styled lecture, which means that, yes, I'm the person who's doing all the talking and I'm delivering the presentation, but in the audience are people who have been in the business for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And they will stand up and make comments about the information I'm giving, and sometimes they'll debate with me. And this way the student gets to really, really learn what's really going on, because there's no one watching what we're saying. You know, we're speaking the truth in that seminar, mm-hmm. and we are teaching how to really maximize the revenue streams in this business, how to avoid getting ripped off, how to make sure you're pursuing the correct career path for the kind of music that you're doing, how to meet the right people, how to figure out who's full of crap and who's not. And to my knowledge, no one else is doing this.
As you were writing that book, Confessions of a Record Producer, were you having any feedback from, let's say, industry people that employed you to keep your mouth shut?
No. I didn't even show it to anybody.
That's great.
No, I wrote that book kind of as a farewell to the music industry. I had no intention of being in the music business anymore, mm-hmm. but because the book became successful, a lot of people started calling me for advice, and so I started, you know, opening up a little consulting practice, and then it evolved and it grew, and now it's become a cottage industry. We have hundreds of clients, and we have these workshops and three other books, and and growing.
There's a section in that book. I taught a class called Studio Management, and there's a section in there where you talk about a recording studio, and it's a chart that you have, really, that explains that there's different prices an artist may pay or a label may pay. Could you do a little bit of that for our listeners?
Well, there's the advertised rate that every studio claims that they charge, and that can be, you know, $3,000 a day, and that's called the card rate because it's what's printed on an actual card. And then there's, you know, the discounted rate, which is, well, I like you guys, I'll give you a discount. And there's the friends and families rate, which, you know, the rate goes even lower. And then there's the spec rate, which is, you know, they don't pay anything for the studio. And so it's important to understand when you negotiate your studio time that the rate that's printed on their materials, on their card, and on their brochure has nothing to do with reality. You can negotiate almost starting from zero.
Well, that's just a small tip of what's in that book, and I really recommend it to folks. You know, it is an essential read. I'd like to talk a little bit more about another book we haven't mentioned called Secrets of Negotiating a Recording Contract, a Record Contract. Is that more for a sophisticated label owner that's starting their own independent label, or do you see that, again, more for the artist who's starting their own label and they need to learn how to negotiate?
I think I tried to write the book on two different levels, and one of them was a more sophisticated level for lawyers and label owners, and the other one is you know, for the average musician. And while the average musician may be saying, well, I'm not about to sign a recording contract, so why do I need to read this book? The truth is that by analyzing the recording contract, you learn how the entire business operates, because everything in the music industry, almost everything, revolves around the major label recording contract. So understanding the business acumen and the business standards and practices and how these companies think about you and your music, I think, is very important when it comes to planning your career.
Well, I think it's accessible to people that just have an interest, a curiosity about what, you know, what really goes inside negotiating a contract. If they don't have a curiosity, don't read it.
The book has found an enormous market amongst lawyers, believe it or not.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, the subtitle of the book, it's called Secrets of Negotiating a Record Contract, The Musician's Guide to Understanding and Avoiding Sneaky Lawyer Tricks. So naturally, every lawyer picks it up and goes, wow, what sneaky lawyer tricks are they revealing? And I get tons of emails from lawyers going, I can't believe you exposed us in this book. And, you know, but, you know, that's life.
That's life, absolutely. Could you give us a sneak preview of a couple of things that people should look for in that regard?
In which regard?
If you're having a recording contract, what things you want to look at that your lawyer may be doing that's not in your favor?
Sure. Well, a common trick is for an attorney to tell his client that he got them a very high royalty. So say, well, they only want to give you 12% of retail, but I got them to give you 15% of retail. But what he might not explain to you is that he didn't work very hard on all the other back-end deductions. So the label promises you 15%, but what they calculate the 15% against is also open for negotiation. And artists like to be able to brag to their friends that they got a higher royalty than their friend, and no one likes to talk about the, you know, they say the devil is in the details. No one likes to talk about the fact that, well, yeah, you've got a base royalty of 17 or 18%, but the adjusted royalty after all the deductions is more like 13 or 11 or 9. And so, you know, you end up not getting as much money as you perhaps your lawyer is representing to you that you are getting. And this is the reason why we have the royalty calculator on the website, because you can, you know, kind of unmask that fiction by just using a calculator.
How are things changing, in your opinion, now that the Internet is such a major player in developing artists? We have MySpace, and we have TuneCore, and we have CD Baby, and we have all these places at The Orchard, etc. We have all these Internet sites that support and that independent artists can use. How do you see that compared to what would mean to me those are tools for independent artists or independent labels to use? How would you see that compared to the power and the clout that a major label deal might give an artist?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword. I wouldn't put Orchard and CD Baby in the same category as TuneCore and MySpace. You know, Orchard and CD Baby are record companies.
Yes.
I know CD Baby doesn't like to call itself a record company, but they are. Orchard does call themselves a record company, but neither of these companies really function like actual record companies. And I'm not saying that Orchard or CD Baby are doing anything wrong, but what I can say and will say is that because of the internet, it has allowed smaller companies to kind of make themselves look really big and important, when in fact they're just some guy, you know, operating a website out of his bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen many scenarios where people will opt into deals. You know, they'll email me, "Moses, I signed this deal, and now I'm not sure about it." And I'll go and look at the website that hosts this deal that they signed, and there won't even be any physical address on the website for where this company's located.
Right.
There won't even be a phone number.
Mm-hmm.
And you click on About Us, and you'll see, you know, a bio of someone without a clear picture, and you read the bio carefully, and they have no real credentials. Well, you can't really track down who they are. You do a Google search on their name, or do a, you know, a personality background search, and you can't find any information on them. And so, you know, the web has been a double-edged sword in terms of record deals. There are a lot more record deals available to artists, but a lot of these companies are just as unscrupulous as the old-style record companies. And they don't call them record deals anymore. They call them digital distribution, or they use some other name. But anytime you're assigning your rights to a company, it's a record deal, and you have to be very careful. Now, things like MySpace are different. That's a promotional tool.
Yes.
And I'm actually a big fan of MySpace and what they're doing and the service they provide. You're going to be reading a number of articles by myself. I already did one on MySpace just a couple of months ago, and I'm going to be doing a couple of more on how these community services are playing a very large role in the development process. I urge all of your listeners to go to my website and get on my mailing list. It's free. You can opt out at any time if you like. We don't sell the list. We have no sponsors. It's a newsletter that I send out to teach people about what's going on in the music business. And it's kind of like, I describe it as kind of John, it's like John Stewart meets the music industry.
That's a good description. Right. Well, for today, we have run out of time to talk to Moses Avalon, but have no fear. We will continue on the next podcast with more in the interview with Moses Avalon. So stay tuned. Today's podcast was recorded at the studios of KEXP in Seattle, Washington. They're on the web at www.kexp.org. I want to thank my producer, Andy Boyd, and I also want to thank David Neveu of musicbizacademy.com for all his support. For more information, visit my website, forefrontmusic.com, and you can email me at chris@forefrontmusic.com.